Good morning. I'm Jillian Findlay, sitting in for Anna Maria Tremonti, and you're listening to The Current. Well, first they scared the heck out of everybody, confirming that what we'd already feared about global warming was in fact real. Then they told us how real, with predictions that scared us even more. Today, the International Panel on Climate Change offers a reprieve of sorts. Disaster can be avoided, it says, and it doesn't have to break the bank. This morning, we'll be talking about how we do that and how the panel's prescriptions square with Ottawa's green plan announced last week. The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued this simple message in its blueprint to combat global warming. We have to do something now. The delegates meeting in Bangkok agreed on the need to quickly and dramatically reduce our reliance on the burning of coal, oil, and other fossil fuels that produce greenhouse gases. Analysts in this country are quick to point out that the recommendations don't square with the Canadian government's blueprint to fight climate change released last week. Critics of the Conservatives call the government's plan too weak and fear that it won't warm to the international body's prescription. We begin this morning by looking at what's in the UN plan, hammered out in Asia this week. Roger Harabin is the BBC's environment analyst, and he's in Bangkok this morning. Hello.
Hello.
Well, before we get to the drama of what happened behind closed doors all week as this report was being written, give us the highlights of what it says. What's the headline this morning?
Okay, I guess the headline is, after years and years of wondering whether climate change is real and whether we could afford to tackle it if it was real and urgent, this meeting has very strongly concluded that climate change is real, but that we can tackle it if we start moving in time, and that we can afford to tackle it. And all those three are very significant findings. And this is a technical body, a UN body. Its findings will go right the way through international negotiations. So it's a really serious and important piece of work. Some people are calling it a breakthrough, and I think possibly it is.
And in some ways, optimistic. They're saying there can be solutions if we choose to accept them.
Yes, indeed, in some ways optimistic. They say the technologies are there, or in the case of carbon capture and storage, where you'd take the carbon dioxide from power stations and bury it underground, that technology is almost there. And they're confident that we can achieve this at an affordable cost. I have to put a bit of a caveat on this, though. Amongst all the euphoria, and people really are very pleased with themselves here, amongst the euphoria, we have to realise that they're talking about stabilising the carbon dioxide emissions in the atmosphere at 550 parts per million. Now, without getting too technical, this is way higher than most scientists think is wise, given the current response of the climate to the CO2 that's already up there. In other words, the climate is changing faster than our ability to comprehend what to do about it. And there's simply not even enough economic studies looking at lower levels of concentrations, what that would take. So although this meeting is a great step, there's an awful long way to go, just even in terms of our understanding, let alone actually doing something about it.
Tell me a bit about what they're saying about the cost, because there is a perception, certainly the government of this country has talked about the very high cost of implementing something like Kyoto, and that has informed many of its decisions for its own plan here. What does this panel say about the expense of action?
Well, this is now the official economics document, and it makes it clear that the cost is very affordable. And I think looking at this, there won't be much of an excuse for governments to say, oh, we can't afford to do anything. Now, just looking at some absolute numbers for the stabilization target that I mentioned, which is probably too high, but that's the one we're looking at the moment. They're looking at 3% of costs to the global economy by 2030. Now, that might sound quite a lot, but you have to think about maybe our economy will have doubled in the next 30 years. So we're looking at 3% off 200%. So it's absolutely minuscule, the amount that we would need to spend. And that's why they're so confident that the new economics is really standing up, that we can do something about this.
This kind of process is often described as agreement by exhaustion, and you've already alluded to the fact that there were trade-offs in terms of things like the stabilization target. Tell me a little bit about the backroom politicking. What were the tensions that were there?
Okay, well, let me start with the United States, because normally you come to these meetings and people say, oh, for goodness sake, the United States. This time, it's completely the opposite. Fantastically cooperative, everybody congratulating the Americans on their contribution. So that's really quite interesting. And there is a sea change underway in America on this topic. And the White House is being infected, may not know what to do, but, you know, it's caught up in the sea change. The real big problem at the start of the week was China. There's a battle for control, I believe. I've been in China for the past couple of weeks. I think there's a battle for control of climate policy going on between different departments in the Chinese government. And they came here imposing themselves very strongly on Monday in particular and then on Tuesday and really dominating proceedings and really annoying everyone. And then suddenly it all cleared up as though the clouds went and they've now people are saying they've been fantastically cooperative too.
What were China's issues? What were China's issues?
Well, China feels, and I think, you know, with some justification, China feels that the world is now blaming it for climate change. It's about to become the world's biggest emitter of CO2. But when you look at the per capita figures per person, you know, North America, you emit six times more CO2 per person than China does. And then China also points out that China is now making all the stuff that we buy over in the West. So they think it's extremely hypocritical for us to ship our manufacturing to them and then complain that their emissions have increased. So their issue was about getting the West to take the blame for the historic emissions in the atmosphere. And although they created a great fuss, eventually they rather graciously backed down and they've got very faint wording in there to make that point. But they, I mean, they made it pretty strongly in the conference and it'll get through.
But they are accepting that they too have a responsibility in this regard, are they?
It's very difficult to say quite what China will do and how far it will act. China is already putting policies in place to try to improve its energy efficiency. But I interviewed the chairman of this panel, Professor Pachauri, and he said, look, there is no way that China is going to make net cuts in greenhouse gases for a long time to come. They have 700 million people living on less than $2 a day, 200 million people unemployed or underemployed, and they're going to have to grow. And the corollary of that is that the West is going to have to cut even more. So there's an awfully long way to go in this debate.
Quickly then, what was the reaction of the environmental groups to the report this morning?
Oh, they're absolutely delighted. You know, normally you come to a meeting like this, the wording is watered down, there's war of attrition behind the scenes, exactly the opposite here. I mean, there was one thing put in that astonished me that it actually got through. This report looks at consumption patterns and lifestyles in the West and very strongly suggests in its diplomatic language that they are unsustainable and that they cannot be carried on through the developed world. And everyone signed off to that, including the United States. And that really does signal that there is a major change in attitudes underway.
All right, Mr. Harbin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The BBC's environment analyst, Roger Harbin, was in Bangkok. So from Bangkok to Canada, as we mentioned, the UN report comes just 1 week after Canada's government released its green plan. So comparisons are inevitable, and we'll begin today, starting right here. Louise Comeau is the director of the Climate Change Project at the SAGE Center in Ottawa. And John Drexage is the director of Climate Change and Energy at the International Institute for Sustainable Development, also in Ottawa. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Louise, let me start with you. Is this a breakthrough? What's your reaction to what you've heard this morning?
It's a breakthrough in, I think, the sense that people are actually listening. This is the fourth assessment report from the Intergovernmental Panel, and Working Group 3 has been telling us for each of those reports that reductions are cost-effective, that we don't need to increase emissions, and that we can prevent dangerous climate change. So from my perspective, it's an important message, one that we've been told before. The difference is, I think, perhaps people are listening.
John, let me ask you, is cost the highlight for you as well? Is that the headline we should be taking away?
Well, yes, but we have to be aware of the fact that they do make a distinction between what they call what is economic and what is actually doable in the market. And I think that's where the whole issue of lifestyles really comes into play. I don't think it's so much a question of making huge economic sacrifices in North America, but there are definitely lifestyle changes required that, frankly speaking, is not always all about economics. The one area in which I would point to immediately in that regard is transportation. And that continues to be a huge worry, even if you look at this report in terms of the recommendations of how we can try and deal with the issue of transportation, they're not very heartening, I'm afraid.
Well, let's go back, first of all, and compare this to what we heard last week from the Harper government with its plan on the environment. What, Louise, what is being recommended today, and how does it compare with what we heard?
I would say there's a stark contrast between what the IPCC has told us today. I'd like to set that in the context of urgency. We do need to keep emissions low so that we avoid 2 degrees temperature increase. In my view and in the view of scientists, there is a dangerous threshold that we cross at that point. So the question then becomes, what does that mean in terms of what we're doing? It means we have to peak emissions in the world, at least getting us on a path toward minus 50 and possibly as deep as minus 80% in the next 10 to 15 years.
So, Louise, let me stop you there. What does that mean then?
So what that means is we've got emissions growing both here in Canada, which represents essentially what's been happening in the world. But the worst of it is that the projections are emissions could go up another 90%. What we've got to do is stop that growth and bring emissions down. The announcement last week for Canada is in stark contrast to that. The government is proposing that Canada continue to increase emissions past over the next 3 to 5 years, and that in 2020, Canada would still be 5% or so above our 1990 levels.
But would be, as John Baird is at pains to point out, 20% below the current level.
No. Well, we need to be in a position of 30 to 60 to 80% reductions below 1990 levels. I know that may not sound much, but between 1990 and 2006, our emissions are up almost 30%.
So this is asking for a lot more than they're offering.
It's not asking for. The atmosphere is demanding, and we need to position ourselves in that reality because the world will start to move, and Canada could seriously be left behind, given that we are projecting to be on the wrong path right through to 2020.
John Jackson, let me ask you then, how does this work? I mean, Canada is a signatory, it's likely to be a signatory to this plan announced today, but if that plan is at odds with what the government's own plan is, what gives?
Well, first of all, this isn't about a country signing on to any particular kind of agreement. In that sense, it's sort of not like Kyoto whatsoever. This is scientists providing their observations as to what they believe is feasible in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Secondly, you know, there is still, I think, a very active discussion that goes on here, and that is, how do we start? What's the best way to start? And even if you look at the European Union, and when they set up their emission trading system, they set up a very moderate one. As far as targets and initial allocations to countries were concerned. And I guess the message here is that perhaps initially what we might want to do is concentrate on setting up the appropriate regulatory framework and making sure that that is working properly, and then we can look at ratcheting up the targets. I would definitely agree with Louise in terms of the eventual goal. We have to look at, by mid-century, some very significant reductions. There's no question about that, and I wouldn't even dispute the number of 80% from 1990 levels by 2050. That clearly is going to be a requirement. The question is, what's the best way of putting us on that path?
Well, let's turn to specifics then. What is it that we can do in this country to come anywhere close to the targets you're talking about?
Well, that's where you get the very active issue and discussion around technologies, particularly carbon capture and storage.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, if we were going to want to continue to invest in the oil sands, which, by the way, are nearly exclusively used for providing transportation fuels in the United States, then we're going to need some very serious technologies that can, in essence, invert the emissions from up into the air back into the ground.
We're talking about a system whereby, in layman's terms, you basically just bury them.
Exactly.
And where are we on that technology?
Well, it depends on to whom you're talking. It's more and more people seem to say it's not a matter of whether the technology is there. More and more people are saying, is there an appropriate price to the fossil fuel to incent actions? In other words, the question is it economic at this point to start doing that kind of thing? You saw the government of British Columbia, for example, in their plan 2 weeks ago, state that any new coal plant that might go up in British Columbia has to have this technology in place. So we're beginning to see very strong, clear policy signals in that regard, and I think that's a step in the positive direction. But we're also talking about, in Canada and North America, an issue of lifestyles. We only have to look at how our cities have been planned and how they've been developed since World War II. We're, in terms of area-wise, we're massive compared to the rest of the world in terms of our energy efficiency, and we have a lot of work to do there.
Louise, do you see in the plan that Ottawa announced that there is a desire to change people's lifestyles to make us more efficient in our consumption of energy?
There's a modest commitment to it, but not a strong program to back it up. I'd also point out that, in fact, we can stop the growth in emissions through technologies that exist today. It's, I think, not appropriate to focus only on technologies to come. It creates the impression we have no power to act today, but we have a huge amount of potential with existing technologies. So we do need rapid implementation of new standards and regulations. The plan last week talked about regulations that would come into play 2012, 2015. We've been talking about this issue for 20 years. Industry should not be surprised. Therefore, there's no reason to delay. We should have regulations for efficiency, for new buildings, for vehicles, for emissions trading. All of those regulations should, in fact, be in place this year or next year. There's no need for a further delay.
So what is a delay then?
Well, the argument appears to be that we need to give industry time to prepare. I've been talking to the same industry folks since 1988. It's beyond my understanding as to how they could be unprepared at this point. Government says it needs more data. Frankly, it's hard to understand why the government's plan of last week, frankly, doesn't look that much different than the plan that Rona Ambrose released a year prior. One does have to ask, what have folks been doing? I think that there needs to be more pressure for more rapid action, and certainly would count on Canadians to insist that at this point we really do need to start moving more quickly. Industry knows what it can do, what it should do. We need the regulation in place to make it happen.
I think it's fair to say that Environment Minister John Baird is already on the defensive after his announcement of his plan last week. He's been attacked by David Suzuki, by Al Gore, and by many, many Canadians and editorial writers across the country, including yourselves. Is this going to make his life worse, do you think?
I hope so. I hope that he takes comfort and confidence from what the report is saying. I know he's tried to create the impression among Canadians that there are costs here, that we need to bear this burden. He needed to do that in order to defend his other claim, which is that Kyoto is unaffordable. Neither of those statements or premises are true, and Canadians actually don't believe it. We can't afford this, and even the IPCC today, even when we do talk to costs, they actually say, look, if you add in the health benefits, if you add in the other societal benefits to this, in fact, the costs are absolutely minuscule.
John, you were about to jump in and say something. What was that?
Well, there's been a sort of an interesting dynamic, and I am in pretty regular contact with what I consider to be sort of the moderate voices within industry. And they seem to indicate that, in fact, they thought that the signals that came out were a bit stronger than what they expected. And I'm not trying to get in this battle as to whether or not the Conservatives should be roundly criticized or not roundly criticized or supported for their particular plan. It's just interesting that it really is a matter of where one sits in terms of what are the perspectives that you're going to bring in here. I do think that one signal that has come in through clearly one way or another is that a regulatory framework is in the works. There is nowhere else for industry to go in terms of political parties.
But
and so that is definitely coming down the line, and we should keep that in mind and in context.
But you say you don't want to get involved, but it's precisely people like you that laymen turn to for an opinion. I mean, what is your opinion? Is it enough?
I'm going to have to be fair here and take a further look at specific details. I think one area that gets overlooked often in this issue in terms of the plan is that it also is very much addressing the whole issue of local air pollutants, air contaminants. And apparently it is in that area where there are some concerns, particularly amongst utilities, as to what its implications may actually be. But I don't want to prejudge things one way or the other.
Let's see
how it comes out in the wash.
John, I'm going to have to stop you there. Thank you both so much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Louise Como is a director of the Climate Change Project at the SAGE Center in Ottawa. John Drexage is the director of climate change and energy at the International Institute for Sustainable Development, and he was also in Ottawa. Thank you.